to get to work. So I'm going to talk about random walk on a line. And again, this is a topic where possibly you feel like you know what it's all about. And so, but I want to try and give you a sense of like how you solve the problem mathematically. And, you know, there's like four different versions of random walks in the line. You can have discrete space and discrete time, continuous time and discrete space, continuous time, continuous space. There's all these different permutations. But for the purposes that I'm going to be considering, it's going to be discrete space. So I have lattice sites that are equally spaced. So here's site n, n plus 1, n minus 1. And I'm going to define that there's a hopping rate between every nearest neighbor site, pairs of nearest neighbor sites, that's a rate 1. And so what I wrote last time was a master equation for the probability distribution. So Pn is the probability that at time t, a random walk is at site n. And how does this change with time? And it can change in three different ways. If I focus on site n, I could have been here and hopped to the right, and that happens with rate 1. So there's a term Pn minus 1. Or I could have been at n plus 1 and hopped to the left, and that happens with rate 1. So plus Pn plus 1. But then at site n, I can either hop to the right or hop to the left. There are two ways out, so there's a minus 2 Pn. So that was my master equation that I want to solve. And notice that the right-hand side kind of looks, it is exactly the discrete second derivative. So if you wanted to take the continuous limit at this stage, you'd have dp by dt is equal to Laplacian, or the second derivative of p, which you could solve by multiple techniques. But let me just live now in the world that's discrete. So some of this, what I'm going to be telling you now in the next hour, maybe this would be more appropriate for a mathematical physics class, but it's also very standard and useful material. So I'm going to do it anyways. Okay, so anyways, there's two ways we can solve this. One way is, well, first of all, how do you solve this? So in some sense, this is a partial differential equation if I go to the continuous limit, because there's derivative with respect to time, derivative with respect to space. And when you have like a partial differential equation, one set of techniques is by doing some kind of spectral analysis, namely Laplace transform, Fourier transform, something of that ilk. So I'm going to apply Fourier and Laplace transform technology to solve this equation. So if I do the Fourier transform, which I didn't mention last time, but I'm going to do it now. So with the Fourier transform, if the right-hand side was derivative with respect to x squared, you would write, well, let me multiply through by e to the I kx, integrate over all x, and then I would get like something, an algebraic equation or a simpler differential equation for the Fourier transform. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to multiply this entire equation by e to the ikn and sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity. And I'm going to define pk of t. I'll define that to be the summation from minus infinity to infinity pn of t e to the ikn. So this is nothing more than the discrete Fourier transform. And so if I apply this operation to the equation, so on the left-hand side, I'm just going to get pk dot here. So I have pn minus 1 times e to the ikn. I can write, so let me just maybe do a little worksheet over here. If I have something like pn minus 1 e to the ikn summation over all n, I can write this as summation pn minus 1 e to the ik n minus 1 e to the ik. And because I'm summing over all n, I can change my summation index from n to n minus 1, and then this just is just the Fourier transform itself, but multiplied by e to the ik. And so when I do all of this, then what's going to happen here is I'll get pk of n, pk of t dot. So we saw that here, the pn, when I do the Fourier transform, there's one extra factor of e to the ik. So this is e to the ik from the first term. From the middle term, it's just exactly the Fourier transform, but with a 2. And the right term is e to the ik minus ik, because I have to sort of multiply, add 1 here, and then subtract 1 to make this the Fourier transform. So I'm going to get e to the minus ik, e to the minus ik, all is multiplying pk. And in order to complete the solution, I need one more piece of information, which is the initial condition. Until I give the initial condition, then we can't solve because we don't have a place to start. This is a first-order differential equation in time. To solve it, you need the equation plus the initial condition. So let me make the initial condition assume, and I'll always use the letters IC for initial condition, which is Pn at t equals 0 is equal to delta n 0. So with this, then this equation becomes the solution to this equation. This is pk dot is some constant times the function again. That says that pk of t is just equal to pk of t equals 0, e to the I. And then so this thing is going to be, let me simplify this because this looks a little bit ugly. This is nothing more than 2. It's actually, it's 2. Cosine k minus 1. So I can write this as e to the I pk, so this is equal to e to the 2 cos k minus 1 t. Okay, and now the thing is that in order to finish this, we have to just write what is the Fourier transform of the initial condition, but if pn at t equals 0 is just a delta function, when I plug it into the definition, there'll be only one term, the n equals 0 term, and I'll just get 1. And so this is just equal to e to the 2 cos k minus 1 t. That's my answer. So now we have to invert this to get the distribution as a function of space and time. And so there's two ways to do it, the hard way and the easy way. The hard way.
What happened from the second to last line to the last line? They're both pk of t?
Yes, but this is, I just specified the initial condition.
Delta n zero, so.
Pardon me?
If it's delta n zero.
Yes, a particle, so this means that a particle starts at the origin.
Okay, and pk is delta.
No, no. I just said if you plug in, put in this delta function here, so pk t equals 0 is equal to summation from minus infinity to plus infinity, pn of t at 0, but t at pn of t is 0, there's only one term in the sum, just n equals 0, and then I just get n equals 0, I just get 1, so this is just all this just is equal to 1.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right, so anyways, to invert this, easy way and hard way, the hard way is that you try and do things exactly. And in this case, you will have no idea what I'm going about to do next, so I'm just going to tell you for cultural information, the exact answer is pn of t is equal to in of 2t e to the minus 2t, where in is the modified Bessel function of the first kind of order n. So I'm just writing this down. It looks like black magic. It is black magic, just to tell you that that's the exact answer. But the thing is that we don't want to rely on black magic. We want to rely on some physical reasoning. And so the point here is that we're typically interested in the limit of long distance, large time, long distance behavior. And so just as we've done that one does in Fourier transform technology, oftentimes looking at if you want to look at the large n behavior, that's the same as looking for small k. So for k going to 0, let's expand this in a Taylor series. Cosine k is 1 minus k squared over 2. This just becomes pk of t goes as e to the minus k squared t. And now this, presumably you all know how to do the inverse Fourier transform of a Gaussian, because a Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. You know that story? Okay. So that tells me then that if I just do the calculation, and if you don't know how to do the calculation, then I urge you to try for yourself. You're going to get Pn of t is equal to 1 over 4 pi t square root e to the minus n squared over 4t. And so that's my solution, the good old Gaussian solution of a one-dimensional random walk. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it.
Why was large k equal to?
Pardon me?
K was just something that you defined as your Fourier transform.
Yeah, k is the wave number or the inverse wavelength. And in general, like if I think about Fourier transform technology, when you have k and n, they're kind of conjugate variables, and large k corresponds to small n, and vice versa. So that's just something that comes from the fact that k and n appear as natural variables together in the Fourier transform itself. So when k is large, it corresponds to n as small, and vice versa.
What I can imagine you having any sort of k there, but you have large n or small n, how would k exactly affect your equation there when your n goes to infinity or when your n goes to zero?
Well, you know, the thing is that you're multiplying by like harmonic waves. And if your harmonic waves are very, very rapidly, if the wavelength is very small, that means that, you know, there's always interference and you don't pick up like contributions from large n. But if the wavelength is very long, almost constant, then you will pick up contributions from large n.
To the IKN, the exponent has to be something reasonable, constant, or not an infinite number.
So well, it's just it's a question whether e to the ikn is rapidly varying or slowly varying. That's the crucial point.
So if n is goes to infinity, k has to go to zero so that the
Exactly. Yeah. And this is like the basic lesson of Fourier transform technology. Okay, anyways, I'm going to now do the same thing because that's what I started to do last time and I kind of didn't go very far with it. Because now let me do it by Laplace transform technology. Solution by Laplace transform. And again, some of this is cultural information, but just so you see that you can do the problem in multiple ways. And you know, when you are faced with solving some sort of a problem of this nature, if Laplace doesn't work, then Fourier might work or vice versa. There's always like ways to get around. And so this is a useful one. So here I'm now going to define Pn of s. I'll define to be the integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus st Pn of t dt. So again, what I'm going to do is, actually, let me bring this down just a little bit. So for the Laplace transform, what I'm going to do instead of this guy is I'm going to take my equation. And now I'm going to multiply by e to the minus st and integrate from 0 to infinity. So it's the same deal as before, but just with a different spectral function. And again, as I showed last time, so I won't repeat this, is that the effect of time derivative when I take its Laplace transform, that's the same as s Pn of s minus Pn at t equals 0. And on the right-hand side, I'm just going to have, I just have Pn minus 1 minus 2Pn plus Pn plus 1. And again, I'm being sloppy I won't be sloppy for this one line here. So this is Pn of s. This is all as a function of s. And if I really want to be pedantic, I could put a tilde over this to denote the Laplace transform. Whereas, in the previous development, oftentimes you might put a hat on this thing to denote the Fourier transform. But I hate writing all this extra crap, so I'm just not going to bother with it. I hope it's going to be clear by context. Anyways, so let's solve this thing. So the point is that for n not equal to 0, our equation is s plus 2, I take the 2 and bring it to the left, s plus 2 pn is equal to pn minus 1 plus pn plus 1. And let me now define a as equal to 1 over s plus 2. So I can write this as Pn, and I bring this now to the other side, so I'll have a Pn minus 1 plus Pn plus 1 brackets. And then there's one special equation when n is equal to 0, because then I have the extra 1. So for n equals 0, I have a special equation, which is s plus 2 p0. And then I have p1 plus p minus 1. If I start the particle at the origin, then clearly there's symmetry about the origin. And so p1 and p minus 1 will be exactly equal. So in that, in this particular case, I can write this as p1, 2p1. Okay, let's skip a step. I'll write this as p1 plus p minus 1, which I say is equal to 2p1. Okay, so now we want to solve this equation. And as I guess my lecture last time ended just at this point, which is that this is a constant coefficient second order difference equation. What is the generic form of the solution to a constant coefficient second order difference equation?
Oh. It should be s plus 1 for n is equal to 0.
Where n equals what? N equals 0?
It should be s plus 1 times p1 because there's a minus pn at t equals to 0.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you for keeping me honest. For n equals 0, it's s pn, then the 2 here, so it's s plus 2 pn minus the initial condition, which is minus 1. Pn at t equals 0 is equal to 1. All the others, or p0 at t equals 0 is 1. All the others are 0. And so then this is equal to 2p1. Thank you. OK, anyways, what's the solution to the equation? Exponential. Very good. So let's try. Pn is equal to a, some coefficient we don't know, times lambda to the power n. That's an exponential solution. So let's plug it into our equation and see what comes out. So we put apn everywhere here. And then we can factor out n minus 1 factors of lambda. And after you do that, what you're going to get here is, well, the a drops out everywhere, so that we don't determine. So there's going to be lambda is equal to a 1 plus lambda squared. So this is called the characteristic equation. And so lambda squared minus 1 over a lambda plus 1 is equal to 0. So lambda is equal to plus, it's equal to minus, so it's 1 over 2a plus or minus 1 over 2a squared minus 1. So those are my two possible values, lambda plus and minus. And now, I'll leave this as an exercise for you to just play with on your own. But it turns out that lambda plus is larger than 1. We'll see this. It'll come out in a moment, but I'm telling you now. And lambda minus is less than 1, greater than 0. So in principle, there are two solutions to this quadratic equation, but only one of them is kosher. It's only the second solution, because this one corresponds to blowing up exponentially for n going to infinity. So this one solution we have to reject. And so finally, we get that Pn of s is equal to a lambda minus the power n. And let me put here absolute value, because the point is that it's symmetric between positive n and negative n. And so this is what the solution looks like. And finally, to finish our solution, we have to figure out what the amplitude is. And the amplitude comes from the boundary condition, or this one special equation. So to determine A, we just plug it into the equation at n equals 0. So we're going to get s plus 2. And then p0 is a to the lambda to the power 0. So it's a minus 1. Is equal to, and then I have twice p1, so that's 2a, and p1 is just lambda minus. So a is equal to what? A is equal to 1 divided by S plus 2 minus lambda minus. So we have our solution. So Pn of S is equal to 1 divided by S plus 2 minus lambda minus times lambda minus to the n. That's our exact solution. Doesn't look terribly friendly, does it? Like, what does this mean? I don't know. And so once again, if you want to try and get some physics out of this, you have to be looking with the right approximative eye, which is you want to be looking at a limit where n is large. We're interested typically in the large n behavior of our probability distribution of the random walk. And large n corresponds to large time, and large time corresponds to small s. Because again, there is this inverse relationship between the transform variable and the variable in real time. And in some sense, in the case of the Laplace transform, it's perhaps a little bit more clear, because what you're doing is you're taking a function of time and you're multiplying it by a decaying exponential. So as s goes to 0, that means you're looking at longer and longer times. You're getting contributions from longer and longer times. And that's why the s going to 0 limit in the Fourier in the Laplace transform is actually telling you something about the large time behavior of the function itself. So let's look at the s going to 0 limit. Yes?
A has minus 2 lambda minus in the denominator. And
did I screw something up? Oh, yes. Yeah. OK, sorry. So this is s plus 2 minus 2 lambda minus. Sorry. Thank you.
And I still, is this, do we demand that at origin it has to be symmetric?
Yeah, but, well, it's not that we demand it. It's just that if I start with a particle at the origin and all the hopping rates are symmetrical, then clearly the probability distribution will be symmetrical.
This random walk has information about the in which hopping step it is on, because it's not, because if you're at your nth step, your probability changes if you go to the n plus 1 or n minus 1.
Right, but there's equal rates of going to both, so that when you average over all possible trajectories of the random walk, even though an individual random walk might be very unsymmetrical, the probability distribution, which is a sum over all possible trajectories of the random walk, has to be symmetrical.
But a particular random walk has information about its previous steps?
No, it doesn't. No, a random walk has no information about its previous step because it has no memory. You know, by definition, the word random walk means a walk with no memory.
Yeah, if you said yes, I would have said that's the problem.
Yes. No, there is no problem here. I mean, the point is that each individual trajectory might look very unsymmetrical, but you average over all trajectories, you get something which is very symmetrical.
Does it matter if it's asymmetrical?
What do you mean it doesn't matter?
I mean
the way you would get something asymmetrical, if
also around the origin it was asymmetrical.
No, but it's not. I mean, the point is that the equation itself for the probability distribution is symmetrical between plus n and minus n. So that means that the solution has to be symmetrical. I mean, the equation itself, I change n to minus n, nothing changes. So, I mean, if we made the hopping rates not symmetrical, then we get something not symmetrical. Here, it's symmetrical. Okay, anyways, I want to extract some physics out of this, because like this does not look terribly user-friendly. And so again, let's look at the limit as s going to 0, because that corresponds to t going to infinity, the long time limit. So if we look at s going to 0, so 1 over 2a is equal to s plus 2, because right, a was 1 over s plus 2. This is s plus 2 over 2. This is equal to 1 plus s over 2. So that's one point. And then lambda minus, which is equal to 1 over 2a. So 1 over 2a is 1 minus s over 2, approximately now. So I'm only going to keep lowest order terms when I expand in a Taylor series. So, you know, if 1 over 2a, sorry. Yeah, if 1 over 2a is, okay, so this 1 plus s over 2. And then I have minus the square root. And so I have this guy squared. So to first order, this is 1 plus s over 2 times 2 when I do a Taylor expansion. So this is plus s. And then I have minus 1. And so this, so the 1's cancel here. Then I have 1 minus root s minus s over 2. For s going to 0, the square root of s is much bigger than the s. So this is roughly 1 minus root s. So that's one approximation. And then the other thing is that capital A, so that's equal to 1 divided by s plus 2 minus 2 lambda minus, and that's minus 2, 1 minus root s. And so the 2 here cancels, and then I have root s and s, but s is negligible compared to root s, and so this becomes 1 over 2 root s. So finally, my solution in the limit of s going to 0 is a, which is 1 over 2 root s. And then I have 1 minus root s to the power n. And for n large and s small, this is the same asymptotically as 1 over 2 root s, e to the minus n root s. First order expansion, this guy just gives me that.
Sorry, yes. Why did we take away when we had A is all that? Why? How come it's not 1 over s plus 2 root s?
Because in the limit as s goes to 0, s is negligible compared to root s.
Ah, you just said that. Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So the point is that, you know, it's very, I mean, I know where you're coming from, because when I was a graduate student, like, I'd always say, well, why are you throwing away all these terms? Like, you can't do that. But yes, you can do that, and you just have to, like, get yourself in the frame of mind of like keeping only the lowest order terms for the asymptotic result. Anyways, the point is that this thing is the inverse Laplace transform of our frame, our favorite Gaussian, e to the minus n squared over 4t. And the way that you can get this is, again, for those of you who know Laplace transform technology, the formal way of writing down the inverse Laplace transform is by, get the guy's name. You know, so it's just that Pn of t is equal to 1 over 2 pi I, the integral from s minus I infinity, s plus I infinity of, you know, Pn of s, e to the st. Oh, Bromwich integral, that's what it's called. And so if you've seen this before, then it's all very familiar, where here, this weird notation, s plus s0, this has to be to the right of all poles of the singularities of Pn of s. And so if you know this, fine. If you don't know it, don't worry about it. But it's just that this is the way to do it formally. And in this particular case, you can do the integral easily by completing the square, and you end up with our good old Gaussian again. So anyways, that is the solution of the one-dimensional random walk problem. So you see that it's got a little bit more mathematical meat to it than you might have thought at first sight. But the final result is universal and important. It is the fact that the probability distribution of a one-dimensional random walk is universally a Gaussian. And this is actually a statement of the central limit theorem, which if I had more time in this class, I would present as a way of showing like renormalization group in a very different context, because basically by integrating out small scale degrees of freedom, you always get a Gaussian independent of what the microscopic hopping rates are, as long as the mean square distance that you hop in a single step is finite and that the average distance you hop has zero mean value, you're always guaranteed to get a Gaussian.
Can I
ask? Yes.
I'm getting a little bit lost here. Like, if we solved the same problem with Fourier and Laplace and we got the same answer, why we wanted to solve it with Laplace as well?
Why?
Yes.
Well, I mean, there's several reasons why. One is I wanted to expose you to seeing how the difference and the similarities between the Fourier and Laplace transform technology. And the other one is to show you that both methods do work. And depending on context, sometimes one approach is better than the other. So at least if you've seen these two approaches, at least if you encounter it again in some textbook or some research paper, you won't feel like, what the hell is this? Yeah, yeah. So I know I'm being a little pedantic here, but there was method to my madness. Any other questions? Yes?
Is it the Bromwich integral?
Bromwich integral, yes.
Is that different from the inverse Laplace transform?
That is how the inverse Laplace transform is defined through this integral. Yeah. Okay. So continuing on my study of non-equilibrium processes, so the random walk is kind of the most universal and, you know, best well-known case. The next thing that I want to talk about is the two-state spin system. And this is a warm-up to understand the dynamics of the kinetic Ising model, which is going to be kind of the culmination of this little story here. So again, we're dealing with a problem in non-equilibrium statistical physics. We want to understand how a system approaches equilibrium using the detailed balance condition as a way of defining what are the flip rates or the hopping rates in state space. And then from the master equation that we get by detailed balance condition, we'll understand how a system comes to equilibrium. So let's look at the very simplest case of a two-state spin system, which you can think of just a single spin that has two states. It can either be spin up or spin down. And let's suppose that there's an external magnetic field H present. So in the presence of the external magnetic field, the energies of these two different states, so let's call this E up, the spin pointing up, and that's equal to minus mu H. And if the spin is pointing against the magnetic field, that's higher energy. So E spinning down is, let me do it the other way around. This is terribly confusing. Let me make the spin down this way because it's higher energy and spin up this way. So the energy of the spin up state is equal to minus mu H, and the energy of the spin down state is plus mu H. So, you know, here are my two energy levels, spin down, spin up. And the thing is that associated with this, there's going to be a rate at which I go from the up state to the down state. Let me call that rate D for down. And let me call the rate this going this away, P for up, capital P. So first step here, if I want to understand the dynamics of this two-state spin system, I first have to figure out what is the rates of going from up to down. And the way we do that is by the detailed balance conditions. So let me put this H pointing up over here. So what we already know from equilibrium statistical physics is that when the spin is aligned with the field, that says that my probability of spin up is proportional to E to the minus beta H. So E to the minus, with the minus here, this gives me plus beta mu H, and P down is proportional to E to the minus beta mu H. So if I'm aligned with the field, I have a positive exponential. If I'm misaligned with the field, I have a negative exponential. So certainly P up is greater than P down, as it must be. But now I want to use this as the in a master equation to figure out what is the rates of hopping down versus up. So let me write down now the master equation. What do I want to say here? Yeah, so P up, for example, time derivative. So how does this change with time? Well, I could be in the down state and I hop to the up state. And so this is going to be, by the way, I'm sorry. My notation is all messed up here. Down for is arrow down. Up is for arrow up. Let's call this up. Boy, jeez. I'm a shugana. Okay, anyways, that's Yiddish for crazy, in case anybody didn't know. Okay, anyway, so P up, how does this change? So we could have been in a down state, and then I went down in energy, and then there's minus up, P up. So the point is that the probability of being in this state, how does it change? I can either have flux coming in, which increases its probability, or flux going out, which decreases its probability. And similarly, P down dot. So if I'm in this state, I can either increase it by going from the spin up to spin down. So it'll be a plus up, a minus down. Okay. So notice one thing already, which is that if I sum this up, P up plus P down dot, well, that's equal to zero. Which it should be, because the fact is that I have only two states. There's a probability of being in one state plus the probability of being in the other state. They better add up to one or else something is bad. So sometimes, like, doing something as trivial as this is a good sign to just check, are your equations correct? So that's something useful to keep in mind. Okay. Let's now apply detailed balance. So detailed balance says that the total current going this away has to equal the total current going that away. Yes?
So I think I'm a bit confused. Are we saying that U is 1 minus D? Or like?
No. No, that's coming now. I'm going to derive what is the relation between U and D.
So is there a non-zero probability of being an up and just staying an up?
No.
You have to get to up from down.
Well, the thing is that unless the temperature is infinity or, you know, if the temperature is zero, then something bad happens because you can't raise the energy. So in that case, the down rate will be zero. But for any non-zero temperature, these two rates are non-zero. And you're sort of anticipating me by 1 minute, because let me derive up and down. And if your question still remains, then you can ask it. Okay, so detailed balance says that the total current going down, which is down times P down, well, that better equal up the current going, the total flux or the total current going up, which is probably being an up spin up times the up rate. So that's a detailed balance condition. And so let's do D over U is equal to P up divided by P down. But in equal, God dang it, P up minus P down. But we already know from equilibrium statistical physics what are P up and P down. They're proportional. What happened here? No, it's, everything is fine. So P up, e to the beta mu h, if I divide by p down, which is e to the minus beta mu h, this thing is equal to e to the 2 beta mu h. So the ratio of these two flip rates is given by equilibrium statistical physics. And clearly, you see that for any non-zero temperature, the rate of going down is bigger than the rate of going up. And so if you're thinking in terms of energy levels, it's a lot easier to go down in energy than to go up in energy. So that's just reflecting that obvious physical fact. But now we have the ratio of these rates. Notice that what it doesn't give us is the actual rates themselves. And the reason why it doesn't give the actual rates themselves is that, you know, if I think about like these only two states and I have the relative amount of traffic going this way and the relative amount of traffic going that way. But it now what it doesn't tell you is like the absolute rate, and the reason it doesn't is because we can choose our unit of time to be anything we want. So if I'm thinking about the traffic going from Waterloo to Kitchener and the traffic going from Kitchener to Waterloo in morning rush hour, something of that ilk, well, it matters. Are we measuring cars per second or cars per day or cars per week? And so depending on what you choose as your unit of time, your flux can be any value you want, but what's relevant is the difference or the ratio of the fluxes. So this is essentially the important physical information.
I'm kind of confused on the terminology. I think when you write balance, you're referring to P plus.
I'm referring to the total current, the total number of.
So for example, P up dots is zero.
No, but it's not yet. In equilibrium, it's zero. But right now, we're going to solve these equations for general values.
If that's the case, and you plug that inside this equation, it's zero. If that equality holds,
right,
that's zero.
The balance is
yeah, but again, the point is, But what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with P. I'm going to use the detailed balance, which is in equilibrium, to fix these rates. And then I'm going to start with some probabilities which are not equilibrium and ask, how do I approach equilibrium?
So detailed balance happens at equilibrium.
No, detailed balance, no. Again, detailed balance is a hypothesis. It's just saying, in equilibrium, if we have our probability distribution in some state space, it's not changing with time, I have P dot equals zero. And so that says that the total flux into a site equals the total flux out of the site. Detailed balance is a much stronger condition that says that if I have like 8 ways to come from Waterloo, from like Toronto and Hamilton and Niagara Falls, whatever, and there's 8 ways in and 8 ways out to each of these places, I'm going to, instead of just demanding that the total flux in from all these different locations equal the total flux out, I'm going to say I want to ensure that the total flux between Waterloo and Toronto is zero, between Hamilton and Waterloo is zero, between Niagara Falls and Waterloo, all of those are individually zero.
But in this case, it's the same. Maybe is what Ali is saying.
It's the same.
Yeah, no, it's the same in this case because there's only 2 states. So detailed balance is sort of dorky in this particular limit. But you know, I just want to work through the details.
I was confused about the word detailed, but I think what you mean now is if detailed balance is just balance of each route, each dimension, whatever.
Each road.
Yeah.
Has an equal amount of traffic going in each direction.
So,
yeah.
What is the Hamiltonian of this system?
Army?
What is the Hamiltonian?
Well, the Hamiltonian is equal to minus UH.
Then there should be no.
That is what?
There is no D and U.
No, no. So in the equilibrium Hamiltonian, there's no dynamics. So again, the point about one of the crucial things about non-equilibrium statistical physics is that there does not exist a fundamental principle that tells you what these flip rates are. And so one has to make some kind of hypothesis. And so detailed balance is a natural one because it ensures that you will go to the correct equilibrium state.
So Hamiltonian is only defined for the equilibrium state.
The Hamiltonian is what?
Can be only defined by
I maybe take off your mask just while you're asking a question because I can't hear. I don't.
So Hamiltonian is only defined for the equilibrium state.
That's right. Yes. Okay. So all right. So that's. I lost my train of thought here, so let me just. Okay, so to solve these equations, those rate equations. So notice that they're 2 coupled linear equations, and they kind of look very symmetrical in form. And so oftentimes when you're dealing with something like this, it makes sense to look at the sum and the difference of these 2 quantities. So let me define S is equal to P up plus P down. And what we've already found is that S dot is equal to zero. That wasn't terribly difficult. But let me now define delta, the difference, as a difference between P up minus P down. And so if I compute the difference, and also notice that from these, that then I can sort of recover. So this guy is equal to 1. The sum of the probabilities is equal to 1. So from S and delta, you can recover P up and P down just by inverting this. And so P up is equal to S plus delta divided by 2. And P down is equal to S minus delta over 2. And this is equal to 1 plus delta over 2. And this is equal to 1 minus delta over 2. Okay, so if we then take the difference of those 2 equations, so I'm going to get delta dot so somebody help me with this. Delta dot, this is exactly the kind of thing I just cannot do in my head. It just drives me crazy, like why can I be so stupid sometimes? So anyways, let me refer to my notes. So I find this just maddening. This is 2D, E down, minus, oh yeah, so okay. So I'm just gonna take the difference. So it's, there's 2Ds and there's a minus 2U, E up. Okay. Say that again?
P should be dotted, right?
No. No, I'm just, basically I'm taking the difference of those two equations. And so this guy is 2D, and so P down is 1 minus delta over 2, minus 2 up, and I'm sorry, this is plus delta over 2, this is 1 minus delta over 2. And so finally, with a lot of pain, unnecessary pain, delta dot is equal to, so there's delta, so there is, there's 2D delta, so there's up plus down. Ah. Sorry, this is, again, this is the thing which I have a lot of difficulty with. So this is, I don't like looking at my notes, but I just can't do this right. This guy, yes, it's down minus up. So that's that term. And then I have minus. Something is wrong with my signs. Yeah, sorry. That's why I'm messing myself up. P down, 1 minus delta over 2. So this is a minus sign here. And this is a plus sign. So that explains why I got so messed up. Anyway, so there's this, and then I have plus D plus up delta. So this is my equation in the best units where I've sort of looked at the right linear combination that decouples the two equations.
Sorry.
Yes.
D minus U delta?
Say again? No?
Oh, right.
It's right. Okay, but thing is, so how do we solve an equation like this? This is now becomes under the purview of something called dynamical systems theory. Has anyone taken a course in dynamical systems theory?
Sorry, should we have a 2 out front of the D minus?
No. No, the 2s cancel.
That over 2 is...
Oh.
Oh, the over 2 isn't just for the delta.
Ah, crap.
No, it's right. The 2 is for all...
Divided by 2.
Okay.
Ah, god dang. The struggles of old age. Okay, anyways. So dynamical systems theory. If you've not taken a course in dynamical systems theory, it's a beautiful subject in mathematics, and in non-equilibrium statistical physics, it plays a really important role. So dynamical systems theory refers to like systems of equations like this, equations in which you have time derivative, and maybe on the right-hand side, it could be some complicated nonlinear function. What are you supposed to do in that case? And it turns out that this is a linear differential equation, so we're going to be able to solve it trivially, but before we actually solve it, let's just try and understand what is the behavior of this equation without doing any work. And the way that you understand this is you plot as a function of parameters delta dot. So I want to so here my only parameter, it's a one-dimensional dynamical system because I have delta as a function of delta. So I'm plotting as a function of delta, delta dot. And we saw already that the down flip rate was bigger than the up flip rate. So this guy is greater than 0. So that means that at delta equals 0, delta dot is positive. So we're sitting somewhere here. And then this is a linear function, and it's going to go to 0 at some value of delta, which is defined by this minus this equals 0. And so there'll be some function that looks like this. And so that's the behavior of the right-hand side of this equation. And what does this say? It says that when delta is less than this point, and this is going to be the equilibrium value of delta, because that's a place where delta no longer changes. So if you're below the equilibrium value, delta dot is positive. And that means you're driven to the right, because the change in delta is positive, and it continues to go positive until you reach the equilibrium point. On the other hand, if delta is bigger than delta equilibrium, then delta dot is negative, which means you're driven to the left. So this is a stable fixed point to this one-dimensional dynamical system. And the equilibrium value of delta is just defined by having this plus this equals zero, and that's delta equilibrium is d minus u, g plus u, sorry, d plus u. And this is, what is this? This is e to the, well, the thing is that we don't know what the actual values of d and u are, but we know what the ratios are. So I could write this as d over u minus 1. So this is e to the 2 beta h minus 1. And here I have e to the 2 beta h, beta mu h, 2 beta mu h plus 1. And then I can factor out an overall e to the minus beta mu h. And this is nothing much than our good friend hyperbolic tangent of beta mu h. So as you, Ali, correctly pointed out, you better get the equilibrium value. And we do get the correct equilibrium value, but we have more than that. We now have the approach to the equilibrium. And so if I solve this differential equation, and because this is a linear first order equation, I'm just, it's very simple to solve it. And so delta of t is equal to delta of, let's see what it's going to be. It's going to be delta equilibrium plus delta of zero minus delta equilibrium e to the minus e to the minus t. Sorry, I'm sorry. This is e to the minus d plus ut. So you see that at t equals zero, this is one. I have delta zero minus delta equilibrium, and so you just get delta zero. And as t goes to infinity, this exponentially disappears, and you're just exponentially approaching the equilibrium equilibrium spin state. So this is a very, this is like the simplest example I'm aware of, where you use detailed balance to like determine the dynamics of a non-equilibrium system.
Wait, this is not important, but it's an e to the 2 beta h. It's not important. You got the answer, but I mean, it's e to the 2.
Oh, here's a 2. Yes, thank you. Yes, it is important, because it's wrong. Okay. Why don't I stop talking for 5 minutes? And so you can either run out or ask questions, and I'll start talking again in 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
Why do we assume that our d's and u's are constant with respect to time?
Well, because, you know, I'm imagining, like, if you're thinking about, like, going from Waterloo to Niagara Falls, there's a highway that takes us there, and the highway has a fixed width that I don't widen it every single day. So I'm assuming that there is this static nature to the transition rates. If the transition rates are changing with time, that's a much harder problem. It's what's known as a non-autonomous system. So dynamical systems theory, normally you have like a set of nonlinear equations, you know, for functions f, g, h is a function of time that do not depend on time on the right-hand side. Those are called autonomous systems. And that's where the whole machinery of dynamical systems theory allows you to solve them. But if on the right-hand side t appears, that's a very different style of problem and much more complicated.
I don't understand the analogy to highways exactly. What is exactly the highway here that is not getting larger or thinner?
The highway is like this little curved line here. It's saying that there's a route that's taking me from.
What does that mean if it gets larger or not? What do you mean physically?
It's, well, physically, you know, I'm trying to widen Highway 401 so it can carry 24 lanes rather than 12.
Yeah, sure, but here, what does it mean? And your analogy, I understand that in the analogy,
right.
You're widening your highway. What is happening here if you're widening your highway?
That means that your transition rates are changing as a function of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're going around in a circle. Yes.
I think he means, how do you physically change your transition rates as a function of time in a two-stage brain system?
I have no idea, because it doesn't sound like a very physical situation to me. I have no idea how to do it.
Well,
I mean, like, one thing I can imagine is, say, like an ecological system. You have, like, you know, a predator and a prey. You know, that the predator is going to try and eat the prey, but if as temperature changes, maybe the prey can't run quite as fast as the predator, and so it's more likely to be caught. So that means that the rate at which the prey dies is a function of temperature, and if temperature is depending on time, then everything is time dependent on the right hand side.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. So why do we have that here?
I don't know. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to implement it.
Okay.
That's much harder from. You're starting with a simple case.
I'm not saying that this is bad.
Yeah. No, I don't. No, but it's not a physical situation typically. You know, normally, you know, when you are the experimentalist, you twiddle your knobs, you put them in some position, then you do some measurement. But if you're twiddling the knobs while you're doing the experiment, that's a much harder situation to try and figure out, like, you know, what are your parameters, because you don't know what they are even. I mean, certainly there's lots of situations where the temperature is changing as you're doing the experiment. So that would be a way in which the flip rates do depend explicitly on time. And that's a very rich type of set of problems. And in fact, people worry about that from the point of view of cosmology, because, you know, we started with the Big Bang, it was very hot. It's getting cooler and cooler as time is going on. And so the expansion of the universe is happening in a system where situation where the temperature is cooling. And so, yes, all the flip rates would be changing continuously with time. So, good point.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, even connection with something to do with Perimeter Institute. Yeah. Can I ask, what's so funny?
Oh, I'm drawing.
Oh, you're drawing. Okay. Just curious. No, it's fine. I mean, you're allowed to do whatever you want, but I was just curious, like, if maybe you had some software that had me, like, as a donkey or something like that.
I wish I was software sophisticated, that I could do something sophisticated.
Okay.
It's just, like, drawing circles.
Okay.
Isn't that sophisticated?
I mean, have you seen those Zoom videos where, like, some guy, you know, you have this thing where they look like a cat? And they don't know how to turn it off. Okay, so I am going to start again. Okay, so what I want to talk about now is something a little bit more physical, and in fact, it's extremely important in the theory of phase ordering kinetics, and that is the spin dynamics of the Ising model. Model. So again, let's just think about the Ising model in one dimension, mean field limit, any lattice you want. So we have like a large number of spins, and we want to understand, if I take an Ising model at high temperature and suddenly cool it to low temperature, like, how does a system evolve as a function of time? And so, you know, from the point of view of a real physical experiment, you know, the spins will start flipping, and that if you're in a paramagnetic state, it'll go to a ferromagnetic state. And we want to understand, like, how that ferromagnetic order is born out of the disorder of the paramagnetic state. And first point is that if we want to develop a theoretical description of the spin dynamics, we have to make some kind of physical assumptions. And so I'm going to make one physical assumption. So assumption. And that's single spin flip dynamics. That means that at any given instant of time, a single spin will flip at a rate that we're going to figure out, and then later on another spin will flip, spins flip one at a time. We're not going to have 17 spins all of a sudden flipping at exactly the same time. So that's not a terribly restrictive assumption, because if the flip rate is high, then the time between successive flips can be very short, so it could look like many spins are flipping at the same time. So that's one assumption. And now let's write down the master equation. And so in this case, we're going to have dp dt. And now the probability is a function of the entire set of spins in the system. So let me write this, and I'll do this once and only once, because it's very hard to write all these curly brackets. So what I mean by p of curly bracket s is that, you know, I have n spins in the system. If they're Ising spins, they can be in 2 to the n different states. So my state space is a 2 to the n site state space. And so and so this is a function of time as well, the probability of a particular spin configuration of time t, how does this change? And so this will be equal to a summation. So I'm just writing down our good old master equation, w s prime going to s p of s curly bracket prime t. And what I mean by the prime here is this is...
Is the bracket closed after the curly bracket of S? S prime goes to S.
Sorry.
Close brackets and then...
Sorry. Close brackets here. Thank you. Yes. So this is... So first of all, this S prime is S curly bracket with one spin flipped. And so in a single spin flip, if I have a state where one spin is flipped with respect to S, and if I flip it back again, I'll recover S. So this is the rate at which you go into state S, and then there's a flip rate out, so there's going to be a minus S going to S prime. So I flip a single spin in state S, and I come to a new state S prime, and then I have P S T. And so this should be a summation over all possible states S prime that are connected to S by just this single spin flip. So you see that it's not very easy to keep drawing this curly bracket. So I'm never going to write them anymore, just to try and I just wrote them the first time to emphasize that our state space is not just one point, but it's 2 to the n. It's a 2 to the n points, and each point in the state space refers to a particular configuration of each of the n spins in the system. So now let's invoke detailed balance that'll tell us the ratio of rates. So detailed balance what does this tell us? It says that W S prime going to S divided by W S going to S prime. So that's equal to P of S divided by P of S prime. So again, in equilibrium, this thing should be equal to 0. And so in equilibrium, that gives us a relation between the total current going one way and the total current going the other way between every single pair of microscopic states in the system. And so we have this detailed balance condition. Now, if I'm talking about the Ising model, my Hamiltonian is equal to minus j, j summation over nearest neighbor pairs, SISJ. And so let's plug that into our detailed balance condition. Let me maybe give myself a little bit more space here. So if you don't mind, I'm going to write it the other way around. So I'm going to write W, I'm just going to flip it over, S going to S prime, W, S prime going to S, that's equal to P S prime, P of S. But let, now what is this thing? So probability of being in a state, a particular state S, that's going to be e to the minus beta the energy. So this is e to the minus beta energy, but minus energy, but since there's a minus sign in front of the Hamiltonian, this is going to be plus beta j summation over all nearest neighbors S I S j. And here I have e to the same thing, but now a single spin is flipped. And because a single spin is flipped, this comes with e to the minus beta j summation S I S j. And just let me check one thing here. Okay, so now I'm going to apply a very useful handy dandy trick. For binary variables. What I mean by binary variable is like SI, which is equal to either plus or minus one. So let's look at e to the anything SI.
Sorry, I didn't understand how PS prime over PS became that.
PS was the problem. It's like it's e to the minus beta the Hamiltonian.
What happened to the numerator? Why does it have a minus sign?
Because that means that a single spin has been flipped that's connected to site I. So one of the terms in here is just opposite to one of every term in here, and so that's why there's a minus sign.
But you're not assuming that it's plus one and minus one, right?
But they're equal to values plus one and minus one.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. So you've got like the sum of all these terms, but this one term has a minus sign?
Yeah, because again, the thing is that this with the little prime here means it's one spin is flipped with respect to like the original state. So here was the original state. And in this case, there's a single spin which has been flipped, but it's one of the spins that's connected to I. So it's inside of the summation. So one of these S's is opposite, and that gives rise to the minus sign here.
That flips the whole thing?
Yes.
Aren't there terms that don't get flipped? Like if you have like five sites, right? And you have site one gets flipped, but you're going to have like S4 times S5, which didn't change at all, right?
Right, but again, it's like I'm looking at the states that are connected to the original state S with one spin flipped. So I'm only looking at the ones where there's one of the neighbors is flipped.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. That's the definition of this like prime over here.
Okay, so you're not looking over all the
no.
All the pairs, it's just
no. Okay. Just I'm looking because it's detailed balance. I'm looking just at one set of transition rates between one state and another state and making.
So this is just like a sum over the neighbors.
Yes. Okay.
Why is detailed balance a reasonable assumption?
What else can you? What do you mean? Why is it a reasonable assumption? It's a reasonable assumption because it reproduces equilibrium, and that it has this feature that to go to a low energy states happens with a higher rate than higher energy states, and that's basically the minimal assumptions you can make that are consistent with reality.
No, but in usual equilibrium, you say the flux coming in from all routes, going out from all routes, are equal. But here you're saying each route.
That's right. It's a huge assumption, and it's just that it's something that makes problems analytically tractable.
Okay.
Yeah. You had a question.
I had a comment about batches question.
Okay.
Because I think like even if you had like S4, S5, it would factor out.
And they will cancel.
It'll cancel between the numerator and the denominator.
Right. Yes. Okay. Anyways, let me just continue with this thing. This is equal to this. I'm not doing anything fancy here. This is just cosh ASI plus sinh ASI. But now if SI is plus or minus one, well, if SI is one, then this is cosh A. If SI is minus one, it's cosh of minus A, but cosh is an even function. So that means I can forget about the SI here. This is nothing more than cosh A. But over here, sinh of, if SI is 1, I have sinh A. If SI is minus 1, it's sinh of minus A. But sinh of minus A is minus sinh A, which is effectively the same as taking the SI and putting it outside the sinh. So this I can write as plus SI sinh A. And then I can write this as cosh A 1 plus tanh, oops, 1 plus SI tanh A. And so I'm going to use this trick to simplify everything that's sitting over here. Because on this, what I can write now here, this is equal to what? So again, I use this trick to write this guy out. And notice that both in the numerator and denominator is the factor cosh A out in front that I'm just going to, I can cancel out.
How do you bring SI out of the sinh and cosh?
Because when SI is either plus 1 or minus 1, here, sinh A, sinh of A is sinh A, sinh of minus A is minus sinh A, which is the same as saying when SI is 1, right, I just have sinh A, when SI is minus 1, I have minus sinh A.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah, so please, you know, I get the feeling you don't trust me, so when I tell you something is straightforward, it is straightforward, but so trust me. And when I say it's not straightforward, then you don't have to trust me. Okay, anyways. But so what's happening here then? So I'm going to use this trick. And so there's a cosh of all of beta j out in front that cancels. And then I'm going to be left with 1 plus hyperbolic. What am I going to have here? So this is going to be 1 plus SI, because that's the variable that I'm pulling out here. And then I'm going to have a tanh. And then I'm going to have beta summation over the neighbors j, sj. And up here I have 1 minus si hyperbolic tanh of beta summation sj. So again, we found now the ratio of the hopping rates. What we don't have is the actual hopping rate itself, but we know that the hopping rate is now proportional to this quantity here. And now it's conventional. And so this is now an assumption, which is that, you know, as I mentioned, all we have is the ratio of the rates, but the overall rate is undetermined because we have to sort of define a natural time scale. And it turns out that the natural way of defining this is the following way, W of S going to S prime, and this is SI going to S prime, is equal to 1 half 1 minus SI hyperbolic tanh of beta summation SJ. Make this a square bracket. So this is the thing that I'm going to be using for the rest of this lecture and next lecture to actually understand the spin dynamics of the Ising model. And notice, but let me finish my sentence and then you ask your question. Just to get a feeling for, like, what does this thing mean? Notice that if all the spins are aligned with the spin itself, all the neighbors of I are aligned with I itself, then this thing is close to 1, this product is close to 1, and 1 minus 1 is close to 0. So if summation Sj is aligned with that means that W is going to 0. So if everybody's aligned, then the rate of hopping out of that aligned state where everybody's happy because everybody is aligned and everybody has low energy and everybody's happy to be with low energy, the rate of hopping out is small. But on the other hand, if summation Sj is anti-aligned, so if I'm a Trump Republican and all you guys are Democrats, you say, you idiot, you know, you don't want to vote for Trump, he's an asshole, so you should vote for our side. And then my rate of being flipped is much higher because everybody's pummeling me, you know, that I should change my state. So eventually I change my state. And in this case, when this is, so when this is anti-aligned, then this is basically minus 1. And so 1 minus minus 1 is 2, and divided by half, it's 1. So here we're going to have W going to 1. So that's why we put the 1/2 as the normalization factor here, because it corresponds to what you'd like to have happen, that when the rate is, that the maximum rate is 1, so we're defining our rates such that the maximum rate is always 1, the minimum rate is 0. So Ali, ask your question.
It wasn't important, you had just missed a J.
I missed a what?
Missed a big J.
I missed a big J. Yes, I did. Yes, I see. There's J here, J here, J here. Yes, thank you. Yes.
I can't understand why we can use this thing in that expression, because SI is under summation.
No, but SI, this is like this. This is summation over all neighbors of I. So these are J, which are neighbors of I. So SI is 1 over here. So this is I and J nearest neighbors. So if I focus my attention on I, then I have to say, you know, here's my site I on the lattice. Here's site I. And then I'm summing over these neighbors, 1, 2, 3, 4 on a square lattice. So in that, so the point is that SI is that one binary variable in this object.
But I thought like we are summing over all neighbors, but that point I is also getting summed over. So
No, but that's a crucial point, because I'm looking at single spin flip dynamics. I'm looking at a particular state where spin I is fixed, and then I'm looking at everybody that's one spin flip away from that state. Okay. So anyways, that is the flip rate of the Ising model. And so what I'd like to do, maybe I'll get to it today, maybe I won't, is I want to now investigate the dynamics with this spin flip rate, A, in the mean field limit, and in the one-dimensional Ising model. And that'll bring me to the conclusion of the story of the spin dynamics. Okay, so let's look at the complete graph. So our Hamiltonian is equal to minus J over N now, summation SI SJ. And here it's conventional to, and this is over all neighbors I, nearest neighbors IJ, which is like every pair of sites are definition by definition neighbors of each other. There's roughly N squared over 2 such neighbors. And in order to have an extensive energy, one has to divide the coupling strength by N, so one has an extensive energy. Otherwise, it's just sort of, it's not a terribly, it's the wrong scaling in this case. Okay, and so what I want to now look at, so maybe emphasize, and this maybe answers your question about the flip rate. Let me call WI the flip rate associated with the state where spin, the ith spin is in a given state. And so this flip rate, so I just copy here, so it's equal to 1/2, 1 minus SI. So in here I have hyperbolic tanh, beta. So allow me to do the following. I'm going to make this 1. Just choose the coupling strength 1 here. So it's going to be beta, so no more J, so it's beta over N, summation over all other neighbors J, SJ. Notice that this sum, it goes over, if I have n spins in the system, so J will go from the other n minus 1 spins in the system. So this object is almost, but not quite, the magnetization of the system. If I were to sum over every spin in the system, I'd get the magnetization. I'm missing one spin, which is spin I, but in the limit n going to infinity, this is, roughly speaking, equal to the magnetization. I'm sorry, it's equal to sort of macroscopic magnetization, capital M, but capital M over N is the magnetization per spin, which is little m. So this becomes 1/2, 1 minus SI, hyperbolic tanh of beta M. Okay, so last thing I want to do here is that, so now let's look at the rate at which a spin I will flip. What is the equation of motion for the ith spin? So let's look at SI dot. So if a spin is up, if it flips, it goes to minus. That's the only state it can go to. In that case, If it's spin 1, it changes to spin minus 1. So the change in the spin value is exactly minus 2. On the other hand, if the spin is down and it flips up, it changes from minus 1 to plus 1. It changes also minus twice the actual spin value. So if I write the equation of motion SI dot, that's equal to minus 2SI, that's how much the spin will change per unit time. And the amount that it changes per unit time is the rate at which it changes, which is W sub I. So that is my rate equation for the time rate of change of the spin. So this, even though I've sort of written it down just right away and it sort of makes physical sense, I mean, there's a lot that's you have to unpack here. It says that delta S is minus twice its value, and the rate at which it happens is the flip rate. And so this is the time rate of change of the spin. So that's my equation of motion that I'm going to analyze. Yes?
Could you say it one more time? I know you just said it, but I missed it for some reason. Why it's twice SI?
S goes to minus S.
Again, it's a binary variable.
Yeah.
So I'm pointing up, I go to minus. So that means the change went from 1 to minus 1. The change is minus 2. If it was minus 1, it goes to plus 1. It says change is plus 2, but that's minus the spin variable because the spin was negative. Yes?
That average magnetization there, always summing on the J's, the neighboring.
Yeah, but in the complete graph, everybody's a neighbor to everybody else.
So this Hamiltonian is like.
Yes. Pardon me?
Like all the spins interacting.
That's right. Every spin is interacting with everybody else.
Why did you put 1 over n in there? Because.
So I have an extensive total energy of the system because the number of neighbors is roughly n squared over 2. So if all the spins were aligned, for example, I'd get an energy n squared over 2 divided by n. I get an energy proportional to n. And in thermodynamics, we always have learned that for good thermodynamics, we want a system that's extensive, that the energy is proportional to n. So that's why we do that. It's just conventional.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so let's see. Oh, I have plenty of time. Okay, so we have this equation. And so what is this? This is equal to minus 2SI and so WI, so that's 1/2, 1 minus SI hyperbolic tanh of M. And so let's see what that is. So we're going to get SI dot. So I have minus SI. And then I have SI with this SI. And so SI squared by construction is 1, because SI is either plus 1 or minus 1. The square of it is always 1. It's going to get plus. Plus tanh of M. And what I can do now is I can sum this equation over all sites in the lattice and divide by capital N. And on the left-hand side, I'm going to get M dot is equal to minus M plus hyperbolic tanh of M. So that's my equation of motion for the magnetization in the mean field Ising model. Yes, question.
When you defined WI, you had a tanh beta M, but then when you substituted it, you just have M. So why did the...
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. God dang. Nothing fancy. It should be everywhere. Tanh beta M. Tanh beta M. Tanh beta M. Thank you for keeping me honest. Okay. All right, so now we have to analyze this equation. So again, notice that this is an example of a dynamical system. It's a time-dependent equation. But on the right-hand side, we have some nonlinear function of m. And so to figure out what's going on here, we're going to have to look carefully at what this equation does. So if you're listening in the control room, if you could bring down the screen, that would be really helpful. Yes?
Shouldn't you have s squared there?
Yeah, but s squared is 1. That's right, because SI is either. Thank you for the screen. So,
interesting.
So hopefully. That's right. Okay, so hopefully this will come on. So what I'm plotting now is I'm plotting the right-hand side of this function. Hopefully it's going to show up. So again, like, how do we understand the physical behavior of an equation of this type? You want to plot m dot as a function of m. And am I plugged in here? What's? Well, it looks like there's no. Oh, this thing that I guess this panel, the display is shutting down. Please stand by. I don't know what's gonna, if it's going to actually work. Well, no, wait a second. Don't hold on. I don't know. All right. So, I mean, I had a nice mathematical plot, but let me try and do it by hand. So I'm plotting m dot as a function of m. So first of all, suppose that beta is zero, which is like infinite temperature. So in that case, well, maybe is this going to work now? You know, so if you're in the control room, like the panel was off, I turned it on, and so now it looks like it's working. So I don't know. Maybe this will work. But the point is that, like, for beta equals zero, then this is just, oh, yes, it is going to work. M is equal to minus M. So we have a plot that looks like this. This is for beta equals zero. There we go. Okay, there's my plot. Excellent. So again, all I'm having here is M dot as a function of M. And so this is, I'm plotting minus M plus tanh beta M. Hopefully you can see all of that. And so let's just play around with what beta is doing. So here's beta equals zero, just what it does. And you see that as a function of M, there's a fixed point where m dot is equal to zero only at m equals zero. And again, if you just think in terms of what is the net direction of the flow, if you're a little bit negative, the flow is positive and you're driven to the origin. If you're positive, the flow is negative and you're driven to the origin. So the stable fixed point is m equals zero. And as you lower the temperature, So let's lower the temperature, which is increasing beta, and you see that now that function starts to develop a little bit of curvature. And so what's happening near the origin is that the dynamics is getting slower and slower. And then at one, it comes in with zero slope, and beyond one, which corresponds to temperature below the critical point, now we have three fixed points. We have zero plus equilibrium magnetization, negative equilibrium magnetization. And before you do any mathematics, if you ask, well, what is the behavior, the dynamical behavior of the system? So if I'm over here, m dot is negative, and you'll be driven to the left until you reach this fixed point. And at this fixed point, you don't go anywhere. And so this is the positive equilibrium magnetization. If I'm just below, between one and the equilibrium magnetization, you see that the flow is positive, so I'm driven to this point. And so this is a stable fixed point of the dynamics. If you're at magnetization equals zero, you stay there. But if you just move infinitesimally away from it, you're driven either to positive magnetization or negative magnetization. So this is an unstable fixed point of the dynamics, and this is yet another stable fixed point of the dynamics. So basically, the behavior of this equation one can understand very easily just by this graphical approach, and this is the right way to develop intuition. And so what I'll do momentarily is I'll just show you, like, what is the analytic solution for the time evolution of this system. So thank you for the thank you for the screen. You can get rid of it now. Yes.
Is it possible to analyze the dynamics of the magnetization?
Is it what?
Is it possible to analyze the dynamics of the magnetization on for example, a two-plane of the magnetization versus some?
Say that louder.
Is it possible to analyze the dynamics of the magnetization without thinking about the specific spin models that we have for the dynamics?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
Like, without thinking about the explicit details of...
Well, no, so I'm saying that this graphical approach is like the best way of getting an idea of what the dynamical behavior is. So this equation does not have an exact solution. And so the only way that, you know, normally in dynamical systems theory, what one does, one finds where the fixed points is, one looks at the stability, one looks at a local analysis about each of the fixed points and tries to stitch together the local behavior to infer the global behavior. That's the usual thing that one does. So in fact, just so you know, is that at some point next year, I'm going to have a course in dynamical systems theory that's going to be on the web. So I'll tell you everything you want to know about dynamical systems theory. You know, you'll see my, on screen. Okay, so I guess this is a reasonable place to stop. So what I'm going to do next time, just so you know, is that I will. What am I going to? Where is my? Yeah. So I'll just very briefly talk about the solutions to these equations, and then I'll go to the one-dimensional Ising model, which gives another very nice geometrical interpretation of the dynamics of the spin system in terms of domain walls, which in some sense are the quasi-particles of the system. And maybe you've heard the word quasi-particles. Sometimes when you have a many-body system, to understand the behavior, one looks at like the elementary excitations, which are the quasi-particles. And we'll see what they are in the case of the one-dimensional Ising model. And that'll bring me to the end of spin dynamics. So that's on tap for next week. So question.
Just a quick question. Does this method give us the same like critical temperature and all that like spontaneous magnetization as the previous methods that we examined?
Well, so according to this Hamiltonian, we see that the transition happened when beta was equal to 1. That corresponds to the critical temperature of the mean field Ising model. So yes, that's what you found in the equilibrium solution. Remember, so the thing is that in our original problem, we basically had, you know, m was equal to hyperbolic tanh of beta jm. And then it was like this thing equal to 1 to find the critical point. So it's the same thing here, but it's just in the mean field limit, there's this extra factor 1 over n, but it's morally the same solution. Anything else? Yes.
Maybe I missed a little bit. How did you get that slip in the box where w equals 1/2 of?
Well, so the thing is that we know that w is proportional to the thing in the numerator, right? Because this is the ratio of the w. So we've solved for the ratio of the w's. So now we have to say, well, w is now this term times some unknown factor. And now the question is, what is this unknown factor? We have no fundamental reason to figure, or we have no fundamental way of determining this unknown factor. And so I'm just choosing it for convenience. And my convenience was to choose such that when the spins were anti-aligned, the maximum possible flip rate was 1. And the minimum was 0. So it's just convention to put the 1/2 here. Yeah. Okay, so thank you. Have a great weekend. And by the way, I should mention, you know, do you guys ever go to colloquia?
Oh, colloquia.
I'm giving the colloquium next week.
Yeah, we gotta go to colloquia.
Okay. Well, so I'll see you there.